From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Confucius said, choose a job you love and you will never have to work a day in your life. But to do this, you need to figure out what you love, the thing you could do for hours without boredom. Sir Ken Robinson advocates for just that. He's an internationally renowned expert in the field of creativity and innovation in business and education. His 2006 TED Talk on how schools kill creativity is the most viewed of all time. He's now focused on helping people find what he calls their element, or the thing that truly brings them joy. This hour on Point, discovering your passions and fitting them into your life. You can join us on air or online. Does your work bring you fulfillment, joy? Are you scared to take a leap and do your passion full time? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Sir Ken Robinson, TED Talker extraordinaire and author of the new book, Finding Your Element, How to Discover Your Talents and Passions and Transform Your Life. You can link to an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ken Robinson, welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane. Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you. We'll get to your book, a lot of it. I want to start, though, with your TED Talk, with that talk that was viewed by millions and millions of people. What do you make of that phenomenon?
Well, it's been viewed online about 25 million times, but it's been seen, we think, by maybe 300 million people because it gets shown at large events all the time. I mean, I know that's not Gangnam Style yet, you know, but I don't have
close.
The moves, Jane, honestly. It's close enough for me. I don't have the moves, but I think it's because the theme of it resonates so strongly with people, you know, we're all born with immense natural creative abilities. Children demonstrate them. We all feel them. But they tend to, we feel they slip away from us as we get older. And I think it's vitally important for personal and every other kind of reason that we focus on them and try to develop them.
So the thesis of that TED Talk, that essentially our system of mass education suppresses creativity in our kids specifically, and you talk about how it's becoming increasingly urgent to captivate these capacities in our kids for not only cultural but economic reasons. Do you think this is unique to the United States?
Oh, not at all. No, I think these are global challenges that we're facing. And our kids are facing a future that none of us can predict. I mean, it's true of us as well. The world is changing so quickly. Technology is changing it very rapidly. We have huge population growth. We have big economic challenges. You know, there was a study done a while ago by IBM. They talked to, I think, 1,500 CEOs around the world of large corporations and public institutions. They asked them what their top priority is. And they said it was creativity. They need to know how to run their organizations so they can keep coming up with ideas, they can be flexible, they can adapt quickly to change. You've only got to look at big corporations like Kodak, you know, that is now, this is a company that invented photography, and it went into Chapter 11 proceedings last year because they simply didn't keep pace with change. So this isn't some whimsical, romantic idea from an economic point of view. It's a really hard-headed thing for business that we need people to be able to think differently and to innovate and to be creative. And the great irony, I think, is our education systems aren't encouraging these qualities. If anything, they're going in the opposite direction.
And so why not? What's at the core of that problem?
Well, I'm not blaming teachers for it. I'm not blaming school principals for it. I've worked in education my whole life, and I work a lot with teachers and schools, and I know they're as concerned about this as I am and everybody else is. I think it's to do with this culture of standardization. There is a view that the way we improve education is to make it more and more standardized. I mean, many people in schools, particularly in this country, I'd say now, are laboring under this sort of dead culture of continuous testing. And one of the results of it has been to reduce the curriculum, to narrow it. So a lot of the things that people listening to this who may be in their 40s or 50s will remember from school, you know, things like band and orchestra and putting on plays and lots of interesting after-school activities. A lot of those things have been pushed out by this culture of standardized testing. And it's all, you know, done with an honorable purpose, I think. The intention is to raise standards, but the irony is it's really not doing it. And more and more kids are pulling out from school. There's more and more teachers, I feel, are demoralized by it. And I know parents are very concerned about it, too.
You hear about you know, the teaching courses in our schools and so much emphasis on STEM, science, technology, engineering, math. And you know, I guess you're not saying that creativity is anti-math or anti-science. You're just saying what? Inject some of this other stuff with it?
Oh, I'm not saying it's against math at all. By the way, I ought to say, Jane, at the front here, that I live in America now. I mean, you probably gathered I'm not actually from Brooklyn. You know, but
Liverpool, but right? Liverpool.
Liverpool originally, yeah. But I do live here now. I've lived here for 12 years. And these, as you say, they're global issues. And it's not an argument against math or science. On the contrary, they're desperately important. But they're not enough, you know. I mean, as somebody once put it, they're necessary, but they're not sufficient. A great country like this depends not only on mathematicians and scientists and engineers, but on people who can work in business, on artists, on people who work in the community. We depend on a huge range of talents and abilities. Actually, there was a very interesting study done a while ago by a man called Vivek Wadhwa at Duke University about the educational backgrounds of people who are running large companies in Silicon Valley. He expected that they'd be from engineering and maths backgrounds. Actually, over 60% of them had backgrounds in the arts and humanities. And what it really speaks to me, is that life is not linear like that. You know, it doesn't depend only on math and science. It depends on these other things too. But by the way, it's not even great for math and science. I speak to a lot of math teachers and science teachers who are just as concerned that this culture of standardization is squashing creativity out of their disciplines too.
I want to listen to some of this TED Talk that you say has been viewed or listened to by 200, 300 million people now. Here you are talking about what you learned from your son's performance in a Christmas nativity play.
Do you know the bit where the three kings come in? Now, they come in bearing gifts, and they bring gold, frankincense, and myrrh. This really happened. We're sitting there, and they, I think, just went out of sequence. Because we talked to the little boy afterwards and said, you know, are you okay with that? And they said, yeah, why, was that wrong? They just switched. I think that was it. Anyway, the three boys came in. Little four-year-olds with tea towels on their heads, and they put these boxes down. The first boy said, I bring you gold. And the second boy said, I bring you myrrh. And the third boy said, Frank sent this. What these things have in common, you see, is that kids will take a chance. You know, if they don't know, they'll have a go. Am I right? They're not frightened of being wrong. Now, I don't mean to say that being wrong is the same thing as being creative. What we do know is, if you're not prepared to be wrong, you'll never come up with anything original. If you're not prepared to be wrong. And by the time they get to be adults, most kids have lost that capacity. They have become frightened of being wrong. And we run our companies this, by the way. We stigmatize mistakes. And we're now running national education systems where mistakes are the worst thing you can make. And the result is that we are educating people out of their creative capacities. Picasso once said this. He said that all children are born artists. The problem is to remain an artist as we grow up. I believe this passionately, that we don't grow into creativity, we grow out of it. Or rather, we get educated out of it.
Sir Ken Robinson, have you seen change or innovation in education that really works?
Yes, you know, it was interesting to me. You know, I was at a university during the last month, and one of the faculty there said to me, he said, you know, you've been doing this a long time now, haven't you? I said, how do you mean? He said, it must be, what, 7 years? I said, how do you mean 7 years? He said, you know, since that TED Talk. I said, yes, but I was alive before that, you know? I mean, I've been interested in this for all my professional life, and I've seen fantastic examples. There are wonderful schools around America. There are schools, I was in a school district in Austin, Texas, this week, who are making a real push to introduce new technologies into classrooms. I spoke at an event called iPad Palooza, which is about how iPads can be put to really great effect in the arts, the sciences, humanities. There's a great program of schools called A-plus schools, which include parts of Oklahoma and Arkansas and states there, and they're doing wonderful work. Now, there's wonderful stuff going on and wonderful teachers, great initiatives. But the dominant culture is the problem, I think. It's this push towards more and more testing and standardization. I ought to say I'm not against testing. I'm not against any form of standardization. But what's interesting to me is that some of the really high-performing systems in the world, notably Finland, which is often spoken about, don't have any standardized testing at all. They have a very broad curriculum. You know, there are these international league tables run by an organization in Paris called the OECD. That's called the Program of International Student Assessment, and they test for student achievement in math and reading and science. And the last round of tests a year or two ago showed that the top performing system in the world is Shanghai. Well, this led to all kinds of anxieties in American political circles that China was outperforming us. But what was interesting is that the people in Shanghai take a different view of it. You know, they say, well, we would expect to be good at these standardized tests. It's what we do all the time. We drill our children in these things, so we'd expect to come out well. Said, but the problem is that for China, we know we have to help our children to become more creative, like they do in America. And that seems to be a very interesting irony, you know, that while Shanghai is trying to be like America, America is trying to be more like China.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about discovering your passions and fitting them into your life with Sir Ken Robinson, who set the internet ablaze with his 2006 TED Talk. He's out with a new book, Finding Your Element, How to Discover Your Talents and Passions and Transform Your Life. All right, take us inside this work, Sir Ken. Why do people need to find their element?
Well, my experience of it, Jane, is that an awful lot of people don't enjoy what they do. And, you know, they kind of get through the week and wait for the weekend. And there's a lot of evidence for that. There's been a lot of research to show there are huge levels of disengagement at work. And you only have to look at other really startling figures like the growth in the sales of antidepressant drugs and levels of dropout rate, for example, from schools. There's massive evidence around the world of people not getting a lot from their lives, of being often angry and frustrated by them. And yet, you know, I also meet people who absolutely love what they do, who can't wait to get to it, who, if you were to say to them, why don't you try something else for a while, they really wouldn't know what you're talking about. They'd say, well, this isn't what I do, this is who I am. I mean, I'd venture to say it's true of you, I guess, you know, that your background in journalism and your work in not just in radio but in print, I should think inspires you every day. I mean, it's not something that you think, well, I'll do this for a bit, but I'll find out what I really want to do at some point. I mean, I don't want to presume, but
well,
I happen to
love what I do, but I have to say, yes, there are some listeners who are writing in who are skeptical. They say, well, yes, but here's Andrew who says, I follow my bliss, but I have to earn a living too. Isn't just this more Oprah type, do what you love and the money will follow? Here's Leonard who says, though possibly good advice, it's also somewhat simplistic advice. The hard truth for most people is that what the world works aggressively to keep it from happening for all but the fortunate few. What do you say to those listeners, Sir Ken?
Well, I'll come back to that. Well, I'll answer it right now. Firstly, this isn't just about what you do for a living. I'm very clear about that. Some people can make a living, as you do, from doing what they love. Not everybody can. It may not be that sort of thing. They may not want to. They may not choose to. I interviewed all kinds of people for the book, who are doing things they love, but they don't want to be paid for it. They're doing it as it were, amateurs, in the literal Latin sense. They do it for the love of it. It isn't just about what you do for a living. It's about having a balance in your life, that you find some time in your life, some point in your life, where you feel you're doing what is really puts you at your most authentic, thing you were really made to do. And to be in your element, you see, to me, is two things. It's doing something that you're naturally good at. So part of the argument here is that we have to have a generous conception of ability and talent. It's one of my problems with the education system. We have a very narrow view of talent, for the most part, in education. But it's not only doing things you're good at, because I know all kinds of people who are good at things they don't care for. As you say, to be in your element, you have to love it. If you love something you're good at, then that's a really great place to be in your life. And it can evolve over time. But my experience of it is, and I've interviewed all kinds of people in all sorts of walks of life, in all kinds of different economic circumstances, that we all have this potential. It takes different forms for each of us because we're very diverse. But it's something worth reaching for because it gives you a sense of fulfillment that you don't otherwise have.
Let's go to the phones. Rihanna is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Rihanna. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I am very excited, Sir Ken, to be able to talk to you. My heart's actually pounding right now.
Hi, Rihanna.
I am one of the 3 million people who watched your TED Talk, and I was very inspired by it. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
I have recently become fortunate enough to be able to quit my day job, as it were, and pursue educational sound art full-time, to it building sculptures, musical sculptures, that can teach a little about sound, the way music works, and how that relates to everyday life. Now, my question is, I can build as many sculptures as I want and unleash my creativity all over my garage workshop, but how do I get that out into the world? How do I find a museum that wants to host it or find the people who will help me get that out into the world?
Rihanna, thank you. What's the practical application, Sir Ken?
Well, I'm delighted, Rihanna, first off, that you're doing something that you really do enjoy doing like this. And I'd love to see the sculptures at some point. I'll tell you, it raised a very interesting question for me about the training of artists. And I was very keen to say to Jane earlier, my argument about the element isn't just about the arts. It definitely includes the arts. A lot of the arts training programs that have been around for a long time have focused on helping people develop their craft, their disciplines, their skills and so on, but haven't been often so good at helping them understand how the world around them works in terms just of the question you're asking, how you get your work exhibited. I've been involved in a number. There's actually Paul McCartney's old school in Liverpool. It's called the Liverpool Institute for the Performing Arts. That has a whole strand there of managing your career, managing your professional career, how you do get your work placed and how you negotiate the world of agents. I always do say it to people who are practicing the arts that if you can find a good agent, then it's often a very good strategy to follow, because it's not necessarily the case that if you're good at the practice of the work, if you're a great sculptor or a great painter, it doesn't follow that you're also equally good at finding the right places to get this work hung and demonstrated. It's like actors need agents. Like, right, I have a literary agent. He's terrifically good at negotiating with publishers. I'm not very good at that. I need to get on and write the book. So I think you may need to find somebody with complementary skills who can work with you.
In this book, you say that sometimes finding your element is about finding the right form for your passion. And you tell a wonderful story about a young man named Randy Parsons. Would you share that?
You know, Randy was a guitarist at school. He wanted to become a rock star, like many people do, as it turns out. And he decided, though, when he left school, that he really wasn't good enough, in his own mind anyway, to make his living as a full-time musician. So he gave it up. He abandoned it and went and took on an ordinary commercial job and did that for years. And then I think in his 30s he was dealing with this deep frustration he had because he loved music so much and loved guitars. And he was literally in the shower one morning, and a thought occurred to him that he could maybe make guitars. He'd never thought of that before, but he got really excited, and he got out the shower, dressed, and ran down to the local hardware store and bought some tools. And for the next 3 years, he practiced making guitars. He didn't know anything about it, but he learned all he could. He never completed it. He set an entire guitar. He just kept making bits of it to try and get it right. And then he met this visiting guitar maker who was passing through his town and became an apprentice to him. And the upshot is that he started to make guitars and now has a whole string of workshops and stores where they sell these guitars that he hand-builds. He has people working with him. And his great dream always was that one day he'd get to meet Jimmy Page, you know, or Jack White. And actually, he now makes guitars for them. He's just delivered another guitar to Jimmy Page, and he said, I can't believe that I'm living my dream like this, that it wasn't playing the guitar that was really my passion, it was being associated with this world of music and making them. And he's become one of America's most successful and sought-after luthiers, as they're called, a guitar maker. And it's a very interesting example to me of how our lives aren't linear. You know, we create our life. We create our life according to the talents that we find within ourselves, the interests that drive us, and everybody ends up having a unique resume. And if we create our life, we can recreate it. And part of my argument in the book is that we owe it to ourselves to look deep inside to see what talents we really do have. Often human talents are like the world's natural resources. You know, they're buried under the ground. You don't know they're there until you go actively searching for them and try to develop them.
And what's the search? What's the process of the search? And for those people out there who are saying, oh, that's a nice story about Randy Parsons. I want to be a guitar player too, but I'm not good in the workshop. I mean, what if your passion isn't something you're necessarily good at? You want to be an opera singer, but you can't carry a tune. You know, what's the process of finding that niche?
It's an interesting thing, this, to me, that there is obviously a balance between between talent and passion. I ought to say this particular book, Finding Your Element, is a sequel to a book I published in 2009, which was called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. That wasn't meant to be a how-to book. It was a book about this meeting point between talent and passion, how it transforms your life if you can discover it, and that there are these two different ways of living, broadly speaking. But what happened was that when the book came out, lots of people were asking me these sorts of questions. Well, you know, well, what do I do about it? How do I find my passion, my talent, if I haven't already found it? And, you know, for a while, Jen, I just said, well, look, read the book again. You know, I'm sure it's all in there. But I really did realise that I owed people a proper answer to it. And that's what this book is about. So there are a lot of practical exercises in this book to help take you through this process. I mean, broadly speaking, it's this. It's that it's a two-way journey. Actually, you know, the word I use in the book is quest. Quest is a very interesting idea to me, because if you take a journey, a regular journey, you might know where you're heading to. You know, you're setting off from Boston to San Francisco. You know where it is, and you'll know when you get there. But some journeys aren't like that. You set off, hopefully, often though not completely sure what you're looking for. That's what the word quest is. It's a medieval term. It's where you're setting out to find something with a purpose and an intention, but you're not quite sure where it is, and you hope to find it. Finding your element is like that. So I say in the book it's a two-way journey. It's a journey inside. We have to spend more time with ourselves. A lot of people, in my experience, don't know enough about themselves, about their talents or their abilities. I meet all kinds of adults who tell me they haven't got any special talents at all, you know, they don't have any particular passions or interests, and I just don't believe it. I think there are plenty of people who haven't found them, who haven't known where to look. It's one of the problems with education, that we get steered away from them. So there are a whole series of exercises in the book to help people reflect on their own talents, things they're good at, whether they really know what they're good at, and there's a whole set of exercises about understanding how your passions come about. And it's an external journey to travel in the world around you and to find new experiences and new opportunities. It's those two things and how they come together that I try to map out for people in the book.
In Boston, Bill is calling. Hi, Bill. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program. You're on with Sir Ken Robinson.
Oh, thank you for my call.
Sure.
Hi, Jane and Sir Ken. This is a great show. My question is, I'm in my 50s and I'm in sort of a creative job, and I'm having a harder and harder time sort of tapping into that sort of creative vein, you know, every day. You know, I'm busy, I got kids, and it just seems harder and harder to to be creative. And I'm just wondering if, you know, you were just sort of talking about that. Are there some tools or are there some techniques that might be helpful sort of in everyday life that I could use to sort of get those creative juices going?
Bill, thank you. Maybe I can ask it this way, Ken. Have you found your element, and how did you find your element?
Well, firstly, I'd like to thank Bill for the question. I should say, too, Bill, that I have kids. We have two of them. I'm actually in my 60s now, and like you, I have bills to pay and all the rest. And all the people I've interviewed in the book are living real lives. You know, they're not on parole somewhere in some idyllic island. I mean, they're all getting on with everything else they're trying to do and the responsibilities they have to meet. But I do think, yes, there are ways of pushing that back a little bit and creating the space that you need to. And that is part of... I have a chapter in the first book called It's Not Too Late. And in this book, there's a whole series of suggestions there about how you can begin to find these opportunities and particularly find other people. This is a key to it, to find other people who are on the same journey or share the same interests as you are. There's a chapter in the book called Finding Your Tribe. And it may be, you know, that it isn't related to the work you do. It may be, even if you're in a so-called creative job, that you need something quite separate from it. I was thinking recently, nowadays we all have to tweet. You know, 10 years ago, nobody bothered tweeting. You didn't know what that was. But I did tweet recently and asked people if they could name jobs that they would hate to do but other people love. And I got all kinds of answers back. I mean, the normal things like proctologist, you know, and I think, well, you know, but they love it. I'm glad they do. But people would say things, well, you know, how about office cleaners? Well, I have somebody in the book who actually loves being a cleaner. Somebody said, what about working in sewers? And somebody immediately tweeted back, you know, my brother works in sewage disposal. He loves every day of the job. You know, you can't make a presumption about what other people would love to do or how they would like to live their lives. That's one of the beauties of the diversity of human talents and interests. But to answer your question, Jane, yeah, I mean, my particular element is to work with people. And I suppose that's evident in those talks I give. I mean, I find if I'm working with a group of people, my passion is to convey ideas, to connect and communicate, and I get a lot of energy from it. It's one of the ways you can tell that you're in your element. That I make a distinction in the book between physical energy and spiritual energy. I don't mean spiritual in the formal religious sense. I mean the sense in which you're in high spirits or low spirits, you know. And if you do things that you love to do, it actually feeds your energy. You know, at the end of a day, if you're doing something you love to do, you can be physically worn out but elated. If you're doing things you don't care for, you may be physically fine but down and depressed. So if you're doing something where time shifts, you know, I mean, if you're doing something you love, an hour can feel like 5 minutes. If you're doing something you don't care for, 5 minutes can feel like an hour. And these different things that feed our energy are different for all of us. So part of what I'm saying in the book is try and track those things. I have a whole series of exercises for people to try and recall, remember, and explore the things that uplift them as opposed to the things they just feel weary about and having to get through all the time.
To Bozeman, Montana, MC is on the line. Hi, MC. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make a comment about a lot of the talk about creativity has been associated with the arts and those types of things. And for all my high school years, everybody thought I would end up being a writer. And what I ended up doing career-wise is I ended up getting my PhD in molecular immunology. And I'm now a professor at Montana State University. And what I have found is that creative side that made me want to be a writer initially is actually really tapped into with research. Mm. And I think sometimes those kind of shifts into a different world, you find that creativity, which is really underutilized in the sciences, and people who are creative are often dissuaded from going into the sciences because they don't think they have a place in the sciences. And really this, you know, fantastic discoveries that happen every day just because of having a creative mind. I can't calculate tip to save my life. I never thought I'd be in science, but it turns out that creative side has really been an asset in my research.
MC, very, very nice. Thank you. Sir Ken.
I really want to support what MC said there. I think it's vitally important to see that this is not just an argument about the arts. So often when people say they're not creative, what they really mean is they don't think they're very artistic. People associate creativity just with the arts, but it's as important in the sciences, in technology. I mean, I am a lifelong advocate of the importance of the arts in education. I think it's catastrophic when school districts and schools cut arts programs. It's very short-sighted, and it cuts a lot of people off from their natural talents. But this isn't just an argument about the arts. It's a plea for more creative approaches in science, in technology. I did a session recently with a whole group of pathologists, and they are deeply creative people, and it exactly mirrors what MC says.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about better incorporating passions and talents into our lives. We're talking this hour with big thinker and king of the TED Talks, Ken Robinson. Ken, you have such an interesting personal story. We mentioned at the top you grew up in a working class family in Liverpool. As a child, you had polio. And I'm curious if you'd tell us how that would affect the direction of your life.
Well, thanks, Jane. Yes, it was interesting. It's interesting to me that you never do think that your own story is particularly of interest to other people. And it was my wife, Terry, we've been together a long time now, 35 years, and she said, you know, you've got to tell your own story in this book. And I thought, well, really, is it that interesting? And she said, no, you really have to. So I did. The broad sweep of it was I was brought up in Liverpool. I was born in 1950. And until I was four, my family confidently expected I was going to be the soccer player in the family. We lived right next door to one of the major soccer grounds, a team called Everton. And everyone wanted one of their family to be in the team, and they thought it was going to be me. In fact, later on, my brother Neil did become a star player at Everton. But when I was four, it was in 1954, there were these big polio epidemics, and I got it. I was the only person in the street to get it, and I was in hospital for a year. I came out, I was on two braces and crutches and in a wheelchair. And I still wear a brace on my leg now. So, I mean, that pretty much put an end to my soccer hopes with the team. But my parents were fantastic, you see. They encouraged me, they pushed me, they recognised that, as my father said to me, that, you know, I couldn't make my living through manual work, I had to focus on my education. And I found it a struggle, truthfully, because I was growing up in Liverpool. In the early 1960s, I was 13 when the Beatles burst on the scene. My brother was in a rock band. He was going down to the Cavern every week. And they were rehearsing my brother's band rehearsing in the room next to where I was trying to do my homework. So I was a reluctant scholar, but I did get on with it, and I got very passionate in the end about theatre and drama. I started to direct plays at school, and I went on to study English and theatre at college, and I qualified to teach English and theatre. And it began a lifelong interest for me in education, and I wouldn't want to over-psychologise it, but I was in special education as a kid until I was 11, and I was very conscious of the fact that I was surrounded by people with all kinds of physical disabilities who were very smart and interesting, and certainly as kids, their disabilities weren't of any interest to us. Collectively, what we're interested in was what people were like and what they had to say and if they had a point of view that was intriguing and if they were funny or not. And I also grew up in a large, loving family, and we're still very close to each other. I suppose my interest in helping people discover what lies within them has quite deep roots. I didn't really think about that much until I came to write the book.
Hmm. Here's a call from Connor in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Connor. Thanks for waiting. Glad you called. Hi.
Hi, Jane. I called because earlier in the show you voiced some written comments from some listeners who seemed a bit critical, saying, oh, this advice is all well and good, but it's a bit simple and we have to make money, et cetera. So I just want to call to say that I had worked for 5 years in insurance and about a year and a half ago quit my job to pursue what's become a pretty successful career as a photographer. And I haven't looked back. And although it has been a lot of hard work, you know, as your guest says, when you love the work you do, the time flies and it doesn't feel like work. So to people out there listening who, you know, are thinking of making that jump, I would say go for it. You know, if you believe in yourself and you're willing to work hard, you can do it.
Connor, thanks very much. Here's another call from Mike in Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
This is
a wonderful show.
Thank you.
I think that much of what Ken Robinson's saying is very, very exciting and very right on. But I think there's a but. I teach college. I teach and study human development. My students are basically average students, and I must tell you that their skill level is very poor. They have very poor reading, writing, mathematics skills, critical thinking skills, and it's not because we have not been trying to teach them creatively in the lower schools. It's quite the opposite. It's also not because of standardization, which is more recent. The problem comes from in the 50s and 60s, when we had a move toward child-centered and student-centered education, where teachers began to pull back, pull for more creativity, initiative on the part of the child, and failed to structure students appropriately. There's an idea that creativity is important, which it is, and that it comes from within the child. I think that that's deeply wrong. It doesn't come from within. It comes from between a child and a passionate, structuring, guiding teacher. Creativity is good, but I'm saying we need more guidance, and that's the route through which creativity comes.
Mike, thank you. Sir Ken Robinson.
Well, can I come back very quickly in a moment to Mike's comment? I just wanted to endorse what Connor was saying, that I actually have an example in the book of somebody who went that same path, who was working in business and determined to become a photographer. And it was a big struggle, and I'm very keen to underline that. I'm not suggesting some Pollyanna approach to this. The book is full of examples of people who struggle against all kinds of odds. Finding your element is not just about passion and aptitude. It's about attitude and opportunity, and it has to matter to you enough. And it isn't about walking away from your responsibilities and leaving everything behind, but it's... I did a session a couple of years ago in Vancouver called the Vancouver Peace Summit, and the guest of honour that I was moderating the opening session was the Dalai Lama. He was an absolutely remarkable and wonderful man. And he said at one point, he said, you know, to be born at all is a miracle. So what are you going to do with your life? And that's something that I think we should hang on to. You know, we're not here that long when it comes to it, and the odds of being born at all are pretty slim, and here we are. And it amazes me how little people will settle for. And they, you know, they'll kind of drudge along. And everybody's circumstances are different. I mean, I describe my own parents and the struggles they had in the book. I say I'm not at all trying to present some rose-tinted Photoshop view of the world. On the contrary, I think people will find the stories in the book very realistic and very gritty from that point of view. But it is about trying to find a purpose in your life and being honourable and true to yourself.
And what about Mike's comment about...
Well, yes, to come back to Mike's book, Mike, I've worked a lot in education. In fact, my whole life, I published a book a couple of years ago called Out of Our Minds, Learning to be Creative. And obviously, there's much more to be said about this than you can cram into an 18-minute TED Talk. But the first thing to say is that, yes, creativity is not just license. It's not just kind of blowing off steam and wandering around unsupervised. I give lots of examples of creativity in the sciences. We heard earlier from MC. A friend of mine won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. Highly creative guy, very disciplined. It's a mixture of knowledge, discipline, and imagination. And often people don't spend enough time to think through what creativity really means and how it works. I think Mike is quite right to say that there have been moments in the history of education where teachers have pulled back too far from their students and thought, well, whatever you come up with is great by me. Real creativity comes about through hard work and through application, but not the sort of application that kills imagination, but the kind of work that encourages it. It's a mixture of those two things, of bringing it together. It's a skilled process. I published a report for the British government about 10 years ago now called All Our Futures, Creativity, Culture and Education. And we talk a lot there about the teaching that's required for creativity to really flourish in classrooms. It's a skilled process. And it's something we need to study more, and that people can't just assume is about kind of letting off the fetters and all good things will happen. But can I just say one quick thing, Jane, as a footnote? Students do have immense talents, and we serve them badly if we don't give them the right kind of frameworks and structures. There are lots of examples we could go into of schools that have come alive with students who are thought to be very unpromising, but who've flourish quite differently when the conditions have changed. And I believe that all of our students have much more to offer
than our
current system often allows them.
Tell us about one of those programs in Venezuela. It's called Il Sistema, life-changing, life-altering experience for hundreds of thousands of that country's neediest kids. Why was it so successful?
It's a great example, isn't it? Years ago, a man called Jose Abreu, who believed that music could be a road to achievement for kids who live in the slums of Venezuela. And he set up this small music program, and it's grown and grown to become a national scheme. It's called Il Sistema. They provide instruments and tuition to slum children in the barrios and favelas of the country. And it's produced the most remarkable results. These kids join at the age of 3 and 4. They play violins, classical instruments, violas, cellos. They form local orchestras and music groups. There is a national orchestra that's grown out of this. One of the alumni of this whole scheme is Gustavo Dudamel, who's reckoned to be, and I believe it, one of the world's greatest young conductors. He's the conductor of the LA Philharmonic now, and is celebrated around the world. But there are dozens of stories of kids who've gone on to careers in music. But it's not only about opening people up to careers in music. What they all tell you, what the parents will tell you, is that these music programs have enlivened the communities. They've pulled these kids back often from a life of crime. They've put them on a different path entirely because they've built a sense of collaboration, respect, and of personal pride in their own achievements. And it isn't that they went round, or even now, go around looking for kids and audition kids who have musical talent. Anybody who wants to be in the program can be in the program. And it's to me, it's a very good example of the fact that we all have deep talents, but you have to work to find them and bring them out.
Here's Ron in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. Hi, Ron. Glad you called. Thank you for waiting.
Jane, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Sir Ken, big fan. I'm a principal of a high school in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, and I produced a professional development piece for my faculty and staff in which we showed your video, and my staff got so energized from your video that one of my English teachers did, which had never happened before in our school, decided to have an open poetry slam for our students, and we were amazed at the talent that our students had that were hidden just because we watched your video. So I appreciate that. I love your books. And thank you so much for what you're doing.
Ron, thank you. I want to get a few more listeners in here. Brad is in Auburn, Alabama. Hi, Brad. Welcome.
Thank you, Jane. Mm-hmm. Hey, I just wondered, I'm a school counselor in an elementary school, and I have found my passion, the outdoors, and I try to incorporate that and the creativity that it brings with my students. But I want to know,
how can we convince teachers to include that creativity in their classrooms when everything they're getting, from the administration, from the state, from the federal government is saying, it seems to be really killing any creativity in the classroom for fear of not doing well on the test and losing their jobs.
Brent, so, thank you. Our time is short, Sir Ken. I'm going to ask you to be brief, if you could respond.
Well, it's a complicated issue, but I completely sympathize with it. Teachers do feel under immense pressure. I love the example there from North Carolina. I think the head teacher can give a strong lead in a school. I always do say to teachers, there's more freedom here than you often think, that if you are a teacher with a classroom, when that door closes, you've got the next hour with those kids and you can work with them in any way that you think is best. Promoting the use of imagination and more creative strategies for teaching and learning isn't the opposite of raising standards. Actually, the evidence in my experience is it's the way to actually raise standards even higher. Standardization isn't the same thing as raising standards. And if you get people excited and engaged, like with that poetry slam, those kids are going to learn an awful lot about language and about community and about working together than they would otherwise have done. So it's important not to see it as the opposite, but as a strategy for improvement.
Sir Ken Robinson, as we go out here, what is your advice? How can someone gain the confidence to jump out of the box when there are only so many hours in a day? A lot of people are just trying to get by doing jobs that they've been doing for many years, but they'd like to do something else. What's your practical advice? Some of these jobs are, quite unsavory, but what do you say to people who want to gain that confidence but don't have the ability or the time even to jump out of that box?
Well, they have to buy this book immediately, Jane. That's the first thing. No, but seriously, I think that everybody's life is different, and it's why the book is full of examples, not just principles. There are stories in there of people who've been doing this, and everybody has to face their own struggles. But, your life's not over until it is over, and it's never too late. And I think it is about taking stock, and I try in the book to give practical techniques to look at the balance of things you do now, to see what time you have. I think if people looked at how much time they spend doing things they dislike, things where they fritter their time, they may well find there are opportunities there they hadn't seen before. In my experience, I quote Joseph Campbell in the book, who wrote The Hero's Journey. If you take the trouble to find your talents and the things that excite you, new opportunities open up that you hadn't even considered were there. It's like a whole new portal becomes available to you. There are lots of examples of that, of people who've found a way forward that they didn't know was there until they started to look for it. So it's about making a conscious effort. It's not a 10-step program, but it is in the end up to you. And what I've tried to do is give some guidelines and tools that'll make it possible.
Sir Ken Robinson, TED Talker extraordinaire. We've heard that today. We really appreciate your time. Author of Finding Your Element, How to Discover Your Talents and Passions and Transform Your Life. Sir Ken, thank you very much.
That's my pleasure, Jane. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. Coming up tomorrow, the bossless office, workplaces where the worker bees are actually the leaders, and how that really works. So we'll go out today with music from Il Sistema. They performed Shostakovich's Symphony No. 10 for a 2009 TED Talk in Caracas. Sir Ken Robinson made reference to them in the program that many, many people have come out of, including L.A. Symphony Orchestra director Gustavo Dudamel. It's quite a success story. That's the music you're hearing now. Tom Ashbrook is back tomorrow. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.